Our guest this week on Changing Course is Gordon M. Burghardt, Alumni Distinguished Service Professor from the Departments of Psychology and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology here at the University of Tennessee. He'll be giving a talk on animals at play at the UT Pregame Showcase at 5:30 in room 213, that's the UC Ballroom, this Saturday. What was your reaction when they asked you to do this talk?
Well, I thought it might be a lot of fun, a type of play that I can get involved with. And I've talked about play in animals, and it's something I really love to both observe and study. So I thought this was a great opportunity.
You have a very distinguished academic career. Why did you choose this topic, animals at play?
Because that's something that I've been studying now for about the last 20-some years. And it's just a topic that I think that lots of people would be interested in. Everybody has their dogs or their cats or their children that they love to observe a play, and people often wonder, why play? What is the function of play? Why do animals play? Who plays? In what context does play occur? And so I thought this might be a topic that would be of interest to a wide range of folks.
What are some of the animals that people don't normally think of as animals that play?
Well, this is one of the topics I'm going to be stressing in my presentation, because everybody knows that dogs play and cats play and monkeys play and bears play and otters play and parrots play and so on. But what about other kinds of animals, animals that are not warm-blooded like mammals and birds? And this is where, until recently, lots of people said, well, these animals don't play. They're not intelligent enough to play, or they need certain emotions in order to play, and we can't register whether a fish has emotions or not. Therefore, let's just consider that they don't. I found out when I looked at the literature and how people define play in a technical sense, all those definitions didn't work. They only worked if you already knew that what you were watching was play. What about seeing comparable behavior in a turtle or an insect? What would you need to find convincing evidence that these animals might be playing also, but we just didn't recognize it? We were so anthropomorphic, meaning that we projected our own values of play and what we think is play, which we can do with a dog, but it's harder with a fish. And so maybe this was limiting our understanding, our ability to appreciate what other animals are engaged in.
Well, let me give you a real-life example. There are some carpenter bees in my backyard that I am convinced are playing with my dog, because I can't think of any other explanation for it. They seem to love to be snapped at, and they jump away at the last second, and they come down, and just this seems to go on for quite a while until the dog kills them or they get tired or whatever.
Well, I think that's really an intriguing example, and it's something we could call teasing behavior. And many animals will do this. They will do these fake mobs, dive bombing on other animals, and crows are known to do this with dogs. And so why not an insect? We actually have evidence of teasing behavior in fish. And one of my former students has an anecdote, observation of this with turtles and a dog, teasing a turtle teasing a dog, coming just within range of it to be attacked in the water and then swimming away and doing this over and over again, very repetitive. And if you see something like that over and over again, then you start to think there could be play. Now, we do have evidence of play in wasps and honeybees. There's some aspects of their behavior that have been interpreted as play. So this could very well be. You just have to know all the other factors that might be going on with bee behavior before you can be quite sure, and you might want to come up with other interpretations and test them. As a scientist, you'd want to do that. But as an intriguing observation that might lead to further study, I think that's a great one.
All right, I got a project here for next spring. Is there an evolutionary basis or a reason for fish teasing each other, or do fish tease non-fish?
Well, we don't really know yet, because this is just the beginnings. Since 20, 30 years ago, nobody would really expect that fish or turtles or lizards would play. We don't really know that much. We still don't know much about the functions of play or why animals play in mammals. And rats, for instance. Rats, surprisingly, are the most well-studied animals in terms of play behavior. And they're studying the brain mechanisms involved, the developmental mechanisms, the ways that these animals interact with each other. Monkeys, similarly, have been well studied, and yet there are many things that we don't know why they're doing it or what the adaptive value is. And certainly the evolutionary origins is even a murkier subject, but it's one that I've been particularly interested in, how play emerged in the evolutionary history of animals. And one of the ways of getting at this is to see how far back, in terms of the phylogenetic history of the animal world, play occurs. And now that we have evidence that it occurs in mollusks, like octopus, for instance, and in insects, and in spiders, and in fish, and in stingrays related to sharks, we know that the history of play really goes back into the most ancient mudflats of history, you might say.
It's kind of interesting to think of animals observing that very football game you're going to be speaking before. Not to bring my dog into it for a second time, but if my dog saw what was going on the field on Saturday, I think my dog would be very scared that this was not play.
Well, certainly the ability to interpret a behavior as playful or not can be a complicated one. For instance, on playgrounds, teachers often misinterpret the rough and tumble play of kids as being aggressive and then stop it. And so rather than make a mistake and let something that may be a fight proceed, they stop all kinds of interactions, including then what is really playful, and they make playgrounds much more boring. That is a factor. Now, what I'm going to try to do in the talk on Saturday is actually, since it's a ball game, pregame, I'm actually going to try to show video clips and so on of ball play in a wide variety of animals to sort of set the scene for the football game.
What's one of the most surprising things you've discovered in your research about animal play? A specific example of something you've seen that maybe you never would have expected.
Gosh, there's so many, it's hard to say. The first time I saw the turtle bouncing basketball back and forth at the aquarium, the zoo, National Zoo in Washington, D.C., that was sort of an eye-opener. Seeing the Komodo dragon play tug-of-war with his keeper, he came up behind him and took the handkerchief out of his back pocket, and then he started having a struggle with the monitor, a very friendly kind of tussle. That sort of really amazed me, certainly, when I first saw it. Seeing frogs wrestling, rough and tumble wrestling with each other, that you would consider true play if it was in a monkey or in a rat even, but to see it as in frogs is really sort of pretty strange, but also eye-opening. And in fact, other people had seen this behavior, but would never have called it play because they were so biased against seeing play in animals other than warm-blooded mammals and birds.
Has there been any study specifically to measure physiological chemical responses to play for some of these unexpected animal play things? So, like, are we able to tell if a frog is experiencing joy when they're doing these things? Or,
well, that is difficult, obviously. We don't even know sometimes whether in our own species, when we're looking at other people, what they are in fact experiencing. And sometimes we attribute erroneously to other people what we think they are experiencing. So to try to do this with, you know, a fish or a frog or a dog even may be problematic at times. But it's something that we do and we have to do in a way to survive in a social world. We have to make interpretations of what other people are going to do or predicting what they're going to do. And same thing with animals. So I think that, yes, this is an issue. Now, physiologically, there are studies being done in a wide variety of animals looking at parts of brain that may be involved in play. And we know that there's parts of the brain that are involved in addictions, for instance, and in learning are also involved in play. Play is rewarding behavior. And so we often say, well, play is fun. Well, again, that's something that's hard to tell. What is fun to a fish? But we can ask the question, is it something that the animal does voluntarily? Is it something that it goes out of its way to perform? Is it something it'll perform over and over again? So maybe we can't say, yes, it's experiencing joy as I would experience it. On the other hand, if the animal will work to go do something in order to have the opportunity to engage in this behavior of play, then maybe it is. One example that may be something that we can relate to are the frogs, tadpoles, that I went to study at the Detroit Zoo, because I'd heard this is an example of, could be an example of play, because I made a claim in a talk that frogs don't play. No evidence for amphibian play. And somebody wrote and said, I think at my zoo, I have an example. And it turns out that these are large tadpoles of a Vietnamese frog, and he kept them in a large, tall, maybe 2 or 3 foot tall aquarium with an air stone at the bottom that had these bubbles that were pouring out and going all the way to the top. And the tadpoles would swim into the airstream and float up, just allow themselves to be whooshed up to the top, and then swim around and do it over and over again. And that's something we could relate to. Hey, that sounds like it would be fun to us if we were in that environment, having the jet stream coming up like a jacuzzi. Yes, that could be pleasurable. So maybe then they are doing this because there is some sensory sensation, some perception that is positive to them, because they do it over and over again, and something that we would find reinforcing or fun if we had that experience.
Now, I have to admit something here. If I knew that mosquitoes had some reward center for play, it would make it harder for me to kill them. I know that's kind of random, but, you know, a few decades ago, people weren't even giving chimpanzees and other species the benefit of the doubt on a lot of this stuff.
Well, you are right that there are constraints, or people are very skeptical about attributing animals certain emotions or certain abilities, because one thing, it seems to diminish us if we have these relationships, close relationships and experiences with other species. But it also means that maybe we're less willing to do certain things to them. So the idea that fish may experience pain when they're hooked on a line, that was very much discounted, because, well, you could do that and it didn't really hurt the fish because they couldn't experience pain. You just didn't scream or didn't have something that we would associate with pain. Similarly, when you put the worm on the hook and it squirms, well, somehow we're not quite as concerned about that, but we wouldn't want to put a live mouse on a hook, right? We'd get really nervous about that, and that would be considered really true, but we do it without question with an earthworm, many people. And when I was a kid, we would hunt with grasshoppers. I would fish with grasshoppers. Sure. You go out and get a thing of fish, and then you hook the a live grasshopper on the hook and throw it to the lake. Now I'd be, you're right, more cautious about doing that.
Well, and plus, we were all fish anyway at one point. So, I mean, there's that element, too, because we came from fish, right?
We share a lot of genetic similarities with virtually all the animals in the world. But even with fish, there are many things that are the same genes underlying similar behaviors, similar structures in our bodies. So we have this deep relationship with other animals genetically because of our relationships.
It does bring a lot of other questions about what we're willing to do to these other species that we have a lot more in common with than maybe we ever realized.
Well, in the years that I've been a scientist studying animal behavior and captive animal behavior, I've seen this transition in terms of people keeping animals in laboratory cages, for instance, in the most atrocious conditions, with no enrichment. And they're just in a cage. It was like a prison cell with nothing to do. And people thought, well, they don't need anything. Their lives, they don't have any memories. They don't really have anticipations. They don't can't feel remorse or grief or joy or pain. So we don't have to worry about that. But now we know that we do have to worry about that. And so many regulations and for keeping animals in captivity, lab animals in particular, have really multiplied. And there's inspections and requirements that researchers have to do with animals in captivity. Agricultural animals, it's more controversial because lots of people are dependent on their chickens and their beef and so on. And so it's more slowly coming to farm animals, a concern about how we keep them, and they have psychological needs. And many of these animals, of course, play. I mean, pigs are some of the most playful animals around, and we keep them, in this country at least, under horrible conditions much of the time. Yet in Europe and other countries, we're becoming more aware of the needs, and so there are more regulations as to how you can keep farm animals, not just laboratory animals, but even farm animals. So there's this growing, you might say, expanding circle of ethical concern about how we treat other species. And finding attributes like play or advanced memory, various cognitive abilities of decision-making and planning in other species really should make us think more about how we are treating them.
You study animals that play a lot, and you've been doing it for a long time. When you look at humans, are you making any sort of connections maybe you wouldn't have made before?
Well, one of the things that I've been interested in most recently is the relationship of play as a source of many of our more complicated behaviors, including rituals. And there's actually an interest over the years of play and religion. And religious rituals, I'm starting to think, have their origins in play. Just as many rituals in animals, societies, social rituals, may have evolved out of play behavior. And they become sort of fixed then in the repertoire. And so we no longer recognize them as play because they become more ritualized, you might say, more standard, more ubiquitous, and we don't see that they had their roots in play at one time. And so I think that many of the rituals that we see in religious and other ceremonies may have their source in play, like festivals and parades and things like this. Scholars have argued are types of play that have become public and large-scale events in our societies, but have the roots also in other societies of different species.
Our guest today on Changing Course, Gordon M. Burghardt, Alumni Distinguished Service Professor from the Departments of Psychology and also from Ecology and Evolutionary Biology here at the University of Tennessee. He'll be talking about animal play at his UT pregame showcase at the University Center, very close to Neyland Stadium, UC Ballroom 213. That's Saturday at 5:30. That's about 2 hours before kickoff. I'm going to bring a frog over there and see what it thinks of his talk, if it's playful or not. Changing Course is a production of WUOT. For more information about WUOT, visit wuot.org.